That's Heart and These Dreams. Just this second, Tony Gosling has walked into the studio. Are you good to go, or shall I give you a few minutes to calm down, Tony?
I'm ready to go.
You're ready to go. Hang on, let me just... That's
when
I'm
in Lord Satan's lair, I'm always good to go.
Okay. Well, welcome to my show, Tony. What would you like to talk about today?
Well, I was really thinking about talking about Mrs. Thatcher.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, maybe people think they've heard everything about Margaret Thatcher, but I mean, I think there are a few things, tales that need to be told, really.
Oh, yeah.
Are these
barking mad conspiracy theories, Tony?
No, not at all. No, they're all documented facts. Now, one of the things people don't necessarily realise is that, I mean, I suppose I should ask you first, shouldn't I? Mm. How's she getting on?
Well, yes, she's burning.
Is she enjoying it?
she's roasting like a good un down here.
I know you've got £10 million of public money being spent on trying to resurrect the inevitable fact that Lady Thatcher will go to hell.
Right, okay.
That's a bit of a waste of public money, don't you think?
Personally, I have to agree with you. I mean, it is a state funeral in all but name, isn't it? They call it a ceremonial funeral, but it's the same thing. It's military honours and the Queen and...
And all prayers. David Cameron's reading the eulogy or something. It's like trying to resurrect the dead. I don't know if it's ever going to work. But I think one thing I would say about Maggie is that her final, I mean, it really, I think she realised in 1990 when she had the big knife appear in her back over Europe that she wasn't really in charge at all. She'd been in the thrall of the City of London, and the reason I say that is because few people realise just how powerful behind the scenes Victor Rothschild was.
Right.
He was, if you remember, back in the Wilson days, he was brought in as part of the think tank. This is what they called the kitchen cabinet.
Yeah.
The idea being that you have a bunch of sort of businessmen and city experts to sort of advise the Prime Minister. Well, this carried on into the Thatcher and into the Major days with Victor Rothschild. Obviously a very, very powerful guy in the city.
Yeah.
But the key thing is, have you ever read Spycatcher?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Because if you look in there, you'll see Rothschild was the big manipulator behind the scenes. He was.
Perhaps you should just explain, you know, the essence of Spycatcher.
Well, Spycatcher was a book which was banned in Britain. It was written by Peter Wright, who was MI5, you know, the military intelligence, internal security. He used to go around bugging and burgling people all around London, and he wrote before he died, he thought, I've got to tell this story. But obviously there were lots of people in the establishment that didn't want him to tell that story, and you know, Thatcher and Rothschild most definitely didn't, and Victor Rothschild appears in there really as the big manipulator behind the scenes, the person who was making all of the advising Margaret Thatcher on who should be the head of MI5, who should be the head of MI6, and essentially making those appointments for her because she wasn't really an expert in the security services and you know, the sort of secrets, the secret world. But of course, he just also happened to be a big part of the big banking family, you know, the Rothschild
banking family in
the city. Now, you know, you might say, oh, this is all this conspiracy. Read the book. Just have a look at Spycatcher. You'll see that, you know, it was him, for example, that suggested the poll tax originally.
Really? Right.
Because as a city man, he was saying, well, you know, you've got to tax every single person the same. And in fact, you know, we think that the poll tax was rejected. Actually, what's happening now with council tax relief being slowly taken away across the country, thankfully, George Ferguson here in Bristol is not expecting people with no money to pay it. But in other parts of the country, that is happening. People are getting bills for hundreds of pounds that they simply don't have. And that was actually the poll tax. So even though we think that maybe we stopped the poll tax happening, back in the 80s.
Yeah, but it is in essence still a property tax, though. It's not a per person tax.
No, it's not. It's a tax on, but it's not on the property owner. It's the person living in the house. That's the point, really, is that if you what Rothschild wanted to do was to transfer property taxes from the property itself onto the person living in that property,
yeah.
And that's what the council tax does. So yes, I take your point that the poll tax was a per head, per person tax, and the council tax is per bunch of people living in a place. I mean, it seems to me ridiculous, and it's one of the reasons we got so many empty homes is because if you have nobody living in the house, you don't pay council tax.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I thought that loophole had been shut.
They're starting to close some of those loopholes, like second homes, you didn't have to pay it. They're now starting to close some of these loopholes. But I mean, that, you know, that is something that very few people realise, is how powerful behind the scenes Victor Rothschild was. He was a frequent, for example, he'd be at Chequers, probably in some cases more than Margaret Thatcher was.
Right.
At the Prime Minister's official residence, he would flit in and out of Chequers. And the other big thing was he played a massive role in sacking the BBC Director General in the winter of 86-87, because there'd been a whole succession.
That wasn't Alistair Milne, was it?
Yeah. I remember hearing at the time, oh, he's resigned, and thinking, you know, how old would I have been, about, I don't know, 18 or something,
yeah.
Thinking, this doesn't sound right, you know, this guy's been battling away and now he's suddenly resigned, no, rubbish. And of course, history has transpired, it wasn't a resignation at all, he was summarily fired, because he'd been backing the BBC's independence against the Thatcher government, and there'd been a whole succession of programmes.
And that's right, he was replaced by Marmaduke Hussey, wasn't he?
Marmaduke Hussey did the sacking.
Oh, right, okay.
The Director General is the sort of day-to-day manager of the BBC, boss in charge of it all. Marmaduke Hussey was chairman of the Board of Governors,
right.
And they basically do the appointments, and Hussey called him in. But in his book, I mean, Hussey felt very guilty, I think, because it completely changed the direction of the BBC from being independent of government to being rather slavishly afraid of government.
Yeah, we've seen that this weekend, haven't we?
So that was, I think, a momentous thing. It hasn't really been mentioned in much of the sort of, in any of, I found, of the timelines of the Thatcher years. I've done my own timeline. That took place in January 1987, amongst all the privatisations and goodness knows whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that Hussey felt a bit guilty about it, because I think even afterwards he said, "Oh, this is BBC should have been independent."
And
I looked at it afterwards and thought, oh, "Gosh, you know, it's not really independent anymore, isn't it?" Even though he was a rampaging Tory, I think there were a lot of people. For example, Macmillan criticised Thatcher. Did you know that the previous Tory Prime Minister said she's selling off the family silver? What's she doing?
Yeah.
You know, that a lot of people realised that was actually a Conservative Party people saying that. So getting back to the sacking of the Director General, in his autobiography, Marmaduke Hussey, before he died, wrote in the biography that Victor Rothschild had come along to him and said, can you sack the Director General? So he, in his autobiography, is laying the blame for this initiative of getting rid of Alistair Milne fairly and squarely at the feet of Victor Rothschild. Now, maybe he's just, you know, being a bit of a scallywag and trying to move it. But you can see that there's this thing going on behind the scenes, and if listeners haven't read Spycatcher, it was not for no reason that Margaret Thatcher and her government tried so desperately to suppress that book. They eventually got it published, I think, in Australia, didn't they?
Well, they did. It was also a bit farcical. You could also buy it in Scotland as well.
So all these places that are now trying to secede from the royalty and, you know, get rid of England, you know, sort of, we want to get away from this place. They were all the places that were printing Spycatcher. But it's a riveting read. It's a terrific read.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, I should reread it. I'm going to play another tune now, actually. And here's one.
Are they picking you up as a music guy at the BBC yet? Because I've been listening to their musical choices. Dire. You know, the Radio Bristol. I mean, we shouldn't speak ill of them. We just have been, of course. But, what are they playing over there?
I don't know. Their listening figures do tend to reflect.
Yeah, it's okay.
They're not doing well. Mind you, you know, I'm broadcasting to millions around the world.
But you could be the Victor Rothschild of BBC Radio Bristol, hovering around in the background, putting interesting CDs on and that sort of thing.
I'd like that idea. This is a bit of Barbara Streisand, but you'll recognise the song.
Once there was a wicked witch in the lovely land of Oz. And a wickeder, wickeder, wickeder witch there never, ever was. She filled the folks in Munchkin Land with terror and with dread. Till one fine day from Kansas, a house fell on her head. And the coroner pronounced her dead. And through the town, the joyous news went running. The joyous news that the wicked old witch was finally done in. Ding dong, the witch is dead.
Witch, oh, witch.
Well, the wicked witch.
Oh.
Ding dong, the wicked witch is dead.
Oh, yeah, happy day.
Wake up, you sleepy head.
Rub your eyes.
Get out of that bed. Wake up, the wicked witch is dead.
She's gone where the goblins go, below, below, below your hoe.
Let's open up and sing.
And ring those bells out.
Sing the news out.
Ding dong, the merry O. Sing it high and sing it low. Let them know the wicked old witch is dead.
Why, everyone's glad she took such a crowning.
Getting hit by a house is even worse than drowning.
Let them know the wicked old witch is dead.
Ding dong. The witch is dead. The wicked old witch. That's Barbara Streisand. Now, Tony Gosling is talking about Thatcher. Tony, I'm going to ask you a question, actually, which it was prompted by the little list you've given me of Thatcher's thingies.
Your timeline.
That's the word I'm looking for. Monetary union. I'm guessing you would actually agree with Thatcher on that one. You're anti-euro, aren't you?
Well, I mean, ask the Greeks. Don't ask me. ask the Cypriots. Ask the Spanish. Ask the Irish how great the euro is.
Yeah, okay, but I mean, well, okay, so the answer is yes. I'm just wondering, is there anything else that you agreed with her on that might surprise us?
Not a lot, really, no. I think the thing is that as soon as she became particularly, single-minded about that, it was literally, I mean, there's a myth, isn't there, that it was the poll tax that killed Margaret Thatcher. It wasn't the poll tax. It was only 4 weeks, actually 3 weeks, before she was forced out, was when she made that speech about Europe saying, no, I'm not doing this. And, I mean, she recognised that monetary union was actually political union.
Right.
But as soon as you give up control of your currency, you're giving up your national sovereignty. And in a way, though, she'd done that way back in 1980, 79 or 80, when she first came in, by getting rid of exchange controls.
Right.
So if you could allow anybody to move money in and out of the country willy-nilly whenever they fancy, well, that can be good for bringing in investment. But then it also means that people can just, for example, move their money into an area where there's slave labour.
Yeah, yeah.
So, say for example, you've got your multi-millions, Lord Satan, and you decide, well, I tell you what, I'm going to move them to Indonesia. Because actually my money makes more money there because the people die more quickly and they have got no rights. And so this is what started happening around the world, is the money started going towards all of the places where, the labour was cheapest,
but
there was no regulation. And this has really meant a kind of the start of the slide to deregulation right around the world. So in a way, you know, she was starting, sowing the seeds of the European Monetary Union and giving up the sovereignty and control of the pound right back in 79 and 80 when she got rid of exchange controls.
Yeah.
And I think if you're thinking about sovereignty, that's where it starts. It starts at your currency. I mean, right now we've got a possibility to control the way the pound goes slightly better than they have in Cyprus with their old Cypriot pounds, or you know, various different currencies. Like the Italians are going nuts right now with if they'd have stuck with the lira, they'd have much more control over what was happening to their own economy. Now they don't. They have to get plane loads of euro notes flown over from Frankfurt.
Really?
Yes, that's right. That's what happened in Cyprus. They had up 10 billion flown in a plane, you know.
Right.
And this is no way to carry on, is it? I mean, you know, also, I'm very suspicious about the banks at the moment. You know, when they keep having these glitches on the... What about you? Do you think that's a bit dodgy? You know, suddenly, your money's disappeared out of your bank account. And that's only just started happening since this financial crisis. I mean, we had sort of 30 years of cash points working.
No, I don't believe that as a conspiracy theory, because, you know, if you know how banks work anyway, that they don't have as much money as is on deposit by everyone.
They don't have the cash.
So why would they, you know, it's all a bit of a sham anyway, so deducting money from people's accounts wouldn't make any difference to
it
that
might
sham.
Be, it might be that they actually don't have the cash.
No, we know they don't. Yeah. That's how banks operate.
They don't
operate.
Have enough cash to supply the needs of the people that...
No, that's what I'm saying. They don't. They never have had. They don't, you know, so...
But they've got a sort of reserve for what you people might need for the next couple of days or whatever, and just, you know, but once people start withdrawing a bit too much cash, and they say, oh, well, sorry, we're having a bit of a problem with the cash points don't work anymore.
Yeah.
We've got a bit of a computer glitch, and...
No, that wouldn't work, because, I mean, you know, that would just... stimulate more paranoia and make people even more likely
I don't think so. I think they have to come up with a plausible excuse as to why you cannot have your money. And that plausible excuse is, oh, sorry, a computer glitch.
Well, you can just...
our computers have broken down for the first... But why? Okay, so why didn't this happen 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago? Why has it only just started happening?
Computer systems do go wrong, don't they?
Well, they go wronger and wronger as time goes on, do they?
Sometimes, yeah.
As they get perfected, they go wronger and wronger.
Again, it'd be very easy just to sort of say cash point out of service, wouldn't it? You know what I mean? I don't buy your conspiracy theory on this occasion.
No, that's a shame.
I was going to ask you another thing. So we've got banking, Cyprus, Euro. I've lost the thread. I better play another tune, I think. I tell you what, Tony, stick around for you're around for hour two. Can you carry on talking after the
course,
news?
Okay.
Bit of Roxy music should take us up to the news nicely. Hang on a sec, that's Jimi Hendrix. Oh, that'll do.
His name's Steve Satan and he's on your radio. He's good and wholesome, but it ain't the Christian show.
Dazza is a looter in trainers and a hood. He trashed his local corner shop, he learned that greed is good. The CCTV nailed him, the papers called him scum. Now Dazza's in the barry place, crying for his mum. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Dazza is a looter in pinstripe rogue and tie, short selling in the city, he made millions on the sly. He nicked our hard-earned savings, then turned around and said thanks. He walked off with the money, and we bailed out the banks. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. When greed's the creed that breeds the breeds, what else can you expect? The selfish scum get richer and communities get wrecked. Some rob us with an iron bar, some a computer screen. And when they say it's legal, that's even more obscene. Dazza is a street kid and what he did was wrong, but probably wouldn't do it if he felt he could belong. Dazza's rich and privileged, he doesn't give a sh**. He takes us for a load of mugs and gets away with it. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. There's no such thing as society, so steal and cheat and loot. Just one thing to remember, make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit. Make sure you wear a suit.
There you go, that's the tip of the stock broker. Tony Gosling's choice there. What was that song called?
Looter.
Okay. Dazza is a looter. Make sure you wear a suit. We're continuing our discussion about life.
He's making a point there, isn't he?
Yeah, it's about,
I mean, you know, this whole idea of full employment. Mm. That's another thing that went out, isn't it? At the end of that
We haven't really had full employment since the 50s.
There's not even mention of it nowadays. The idea that everyone must have a job. Now, that was normal. And this is one of the points that Ken Livingstone made on the telly on Newsnight last Monday night. Was, look, you know, nowadays, if there's only one person going out to work in the household, it's not enough.
You know,
and he was saying when he was brought up, I mean, okay, yeah, I mean, that was in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s as well. It's fair to say pretty much everybody could get a job. Mm. In fact, when you went for a job, you had a kind of negotiating position with the person who was going to employ you. And you could say, well, I mean, I'd like my hours to be about this. And then they were, hang on a minute, that's no good. And there was actually a bit of negotiation goes on. Now there's none of that.
Yeah.
It's just your CV or whatever, it's either in the bin or, you know, you come in for a grilling and, you know, you have to be desperate for a job nowadays.
Yeah,
you know, that's the way things are. And that's the big change, I think, is that, you know, full employment, the idea that everybody who needs a job can get one. I mean, the Roundtree Trust did a survey about 2-3 weeks ago where they've made it absolutely, I mean, there's no doubt about this, is no conspiracy. 6.5 million people in this country now are after a full-time job.
Right.
Six and a half million people.
Right.
Now, you know, and you've got literally thousands of people going for, you know, individual jobs. We had a job at DFS was talked about. This is here in Bristol. Just an ordinary job.
Yeah.
Over 1,000 people applied for this one job.
Right.
So that's what's changed, I think, you know, post-Thatcher. And, you know, that I don't think has really been explained quite well enough. You know, the income that people are getting from their jobs now is simply not enough. And also, many, many millions of young of low-paid people are having to claim benefits at the same time, whether that's to help with their housing, with bringing up the kids, or whatever. You know, they're on things like tax credits, and you know, so now the idea that you would have a job and then also be having to claim benefits before Thatcher was totally unthinkable.
Well, I think that's true. You know, there was unemployment in the 70s, wasn't there? And
no, I'm saying if you have a job,
Oh, sorry, supplement,
and claim benefits.
Well, even then, it's,
at the same time,
there was a child allowance or whatever it was called then, wasn't there?
Yes, I mean there was milk for the kids at school too.
Milk tokens, yeah. Okay, I just want to go back to the idea about you know, Thatcher being ousted not by the poll tax. You know, there is this conventional wisdom, isn't there? And I think it's true that, you know, that governments lose elections, don't they? It's not the opposition that wins it, it's the government that loses. When there's a kind of critical mass of loss of confidence in
well, elections do seem to be about the lesser of several different evils.
Yes, they do,
don't they?
Yeah. And so you don't think that the poll tax riots and the unpopularity of the poll tax in itself was a sort of tipping point?
No, it wasn't. No, I think it was. If you look at the timeline, I mean, we're talking about October, November, 1990. October the 30th, Margaret Thatcher says no, speech in the Commons makes it clear she's set against European Monetary Union.
Yeah.
There will be no European Monetary Union.
Okay, well, that's okay, fine.
And then on the 13th of November, 2 weeks later, Geoffrey Howe resigns in protest at Thatcher's refusal to agree a timetable for monetary union.
Right.
That's
right.
Why he resigned.
Yeah.
The next day, Heseltine challenges Thatcher for the party leadership on the 14th of November. So if you actually look at the timeline, it seems pretty clear that this is all to do with whether or not she is prepared to sign up to monetary union. Now, I know this is Major, who was brought in almost immediately after her, signed the Maastricht Treaty, which was about monetary union, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't think it is. You see, I think that's the political class interpretation, if you know what I mean. Whereas Joe Public, who really doesn't care about whether Geoffrey Howe resigns in protest over Maggie's, you know, refusal to sign up for monetary, do you know what I mean? Your average Sun reader, your Mirror reader, they don't care about that.
But there is a plan.
But they have a vote.
There is a plan for monetary union. Right.
Sure,
Britain has resisted that, and Margaret Thatcher is one of the reasons that we now still have a degree of independence from Frankfurt on the way we run our economy.
Yeah,
because we have a pound still.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on to Cameron and his government. I mean, no. It's pretty obvious what he's trying to do politically in terms of, you know, making the rich richer and the poor poorer and so on. But I want to try and understand what Cameron's logic is in terms of having a hope in hell of winning the next election. It seems to me that right from the get-go, he has made himself unpopular. And what do you think Cameron's strategy is to win the next election?
Well, it may be a crash and burn policy. Well, we don't actually think we are going to win.
But do you think right from the start he would have had that philosophy?
Not necessarily.
Right.
Although I do think he's a bit of a chancer. I mean, these Bullingdon Club chaps, they are all a little bit like that. You know, they are chancers. To a certain extent, you know, that appeals to some people. This guy's going to do what he can. You know, you don't necessarily trust him, but, you know, he's got charisma of some sort. Now, certainly Boris has got some charisma.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah,
And I mean, if you look at where they sit in the ruling class, I mean, they're all obviously Eton lads. Bullingdon Club, Oxford, you know, sort of what they used to do is go around, you know, how much do you know about the Bullingdon Club?
A little bit, yeah. They used to go around just causing trouble and
they had
being
a reputation.
Rich boys,
They had a reputation. I lived in Oxford for about 4 years, and, you know, the Bullingdon Club, even then, this is back in the mid late 90s, had a reputation for smashing places up and being incredibly violent.
Right.
I mean, what they'd do is they'd have every time they had new recruits. Every time there's a sort of bunch of freshers coming into Oxford, they get a bunch of new recruits in.
Yeah.
And the older Bullingdon Club lads would blood the new ones, right? Each one had to be cut with a glass.
Right.
Yeah. In a raucous party and smash them. It's probably exactly your kind of event, actually. And smash the place up, get incredibly drunk, probably drugs too, you know, yeah, cocaine, yeah, yeah, basically. And that was the Bullingdon Club. These were not the nice aristocracy at all. These are the ones who are prepared to really, you know, sort of beat people up and, you know, get really aggressive. And there were incidents, you know, with a lot of aggression. Mostly, has to be said, though, not violence against people, against property, places being smashed, you know, sort of glasses being smashed up, dining halls being smashed up, paintings being smashed, you know, windows being smashed, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, is that really the bunch of people that... And, of course, they've got this we're born to rule,
you know, attitude,
right? Well, you know, almost like we're above the law. Now, this starts coming back, doesn't it, to the city, the big boys in the city. Look, there was a brilliant article in The Independent last week by Rowan Boswell Davis, who's an ex-fraud squad copper, and he used to bang down the doors of the city bankers at 4 o'clock in the morning for fraud. Yeah, and that was in the good old days, right? But he said that one of the lunches that he had with one of the heads of the high street banks, this guy said, "Don't think that there'll be any problem with us with the courts. We don't really worry about the courts. We're a protected species." And that's the thought sort of attitude the Bullingdon Club had too. So, you know, bang goes the old fashioned, you know, honourable aristocracy, if they ever existed at all. These guys are chancers, and they really are. And I don't know how, you know, what quite... Maybe Cameron's just going to go off like Tony Blair did afterwards and, you know, have a sort of... get paid £1 million per speech, you know. Mm. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's going to... Maybe there's a couple of seats around the Carlisle Group, one of these big investment companies' boardroom tables that's been dusted off, ready for Mr Cameron.
Yeah.
You know, John Major, that's what he did when he left. He became a... one of the directors of the Carlisle Group. Now, Carlisle Group owns, I don't think it's quite a majority share, but it's a very large share in Kinetic, which is the military research. It used to be a nationalised thing. Major was involved in selling it off, and then he gets a seat on the board of the Carlisle Group that virtually owns it, you know. So this is maybe what's going on, is a bit of looting from the top and then a pat on the back when you leave office. Right, you've got a nice cushy job here.
Okay.
Does that float your boat?
Well, you may be right. I don't know. It seems to me that most politicians are looking towards re-election, aren't they? You know, and it seems that Cameron just hasn't got a clue in that regard.
Well, you might find that they swap leaders just 6 months before the election. And I mean, I think that one thing, if we can rewind a few years back to when Brown was in charge, you know, when just after he took over from Blair, if he'd have called a general election then, he would have almost certainly got in, I thought. Absolutely. And I remember that weekend when he was supposed to be deciding at Chequers, and, you know, what a fool.
And he followed the exact pattern of Callaghan in 78 or 79, wasn't it?
They didn't know what they're doing.
History repeating itself.
They didn't know what they're doing.
So what is Clegg's philosophy then? Because it seems to me, you know, he has done so much harm to the Lib Dems by allowing some of the most outrageous Tory policies through. What
do you know, back in the 1800s, right, a tiny little party held the balance of power, rather like the big Lib Dems do now.
Yeah.
And this was the Irish MPs.
Oh, yeah.
Who were, in the days before Irish independence, people elected MPs in Ireland to come over to London. There was a bunch of, just a handful of these Irish MPs.
Yeah.
And because of the Whigs and the Tories back in the late 1800s, they were the two big parties, a bit like Labour and Conservative now. Now, this little tiny party, because they held that balance of power, managed to squeeze exactly what they wanted out of them.
Yeah.
Now, what have the Liberal Democrats squeezed out of Mr. David Cameron?
I'm struggling to think of anything, really, you know.
Well, they will say, we've reduced the tax threshold for... I mean, and many of those people who were probably the tax threshold being reduced may have been getting benefits anyway. You know, this is all very marginal stuff that they've helped. I don't really think they've achieved anything. I don't think Clegg has achieved anything. And he does seem like the human shield, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't
he
the human shield? Every time there's something terrible to announce, it's Mr. Clegg that appears on the 9 o'clock, no, the 10 o'clock news. You know, it's all rather cynical, isn't it? And he's Poodle. Yeah, he's a little Poodle. He strokes him. He sends him off to give all the bad announcements and to take all the bad publicity.
Yeah, I think
I don't know what the Lib Dems think they're up to.
I don't know. I'd love to know. I'd love to speak to
them. They're obviously not. They're obviously no democracy in the Liberal Democrat
Party. Get Steve Williams in on your show then.
If he's in charge, well, I do ask them these things, and they'll say, "Well, actually, they will agree." Many of the Lib Dems, Steve Como, who's the former leader of the Lib Dems in Bristol, was saying on the show, on the Friday Drive show from 5 till 7, if I can plug it, the other day, that this whole business of secret courts. Which is being brought in at the moment by Ken Clark, the Bilderberger. He's brought that in, the secret courts thing, but the Liberal Democrat Party entire conference voted against it. But Clegg said, "Oh, I'm going to ignore the party conference, and we're going to actually vote for the secret courts." Now, this is the end of habeas corpus, man. You know, this really is. The idea that it's a bit like Guantanamo now. If you're in jail, the police lock you up for more than 24 hours, and people don't know where you are. They will be able to say, right, well, we can't tell you where they are because there's been a secret court hearing and we have decided that they need to stay in jail and we're not going to tell you why.
Right.
So this is Ken Clark. I mentioned the Bilderbergers. We just had an announcement over the weekend. Bilderberg. Do you know about these people?
Yeah.
They were started by an ex-SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, in the 1950s. They bring together all of the most rich and powerful people in Western Europe, and the BBC never report on them. We have had people in there. Charlie Skelton at The Guardian, if anyone's interested in finding out a bit more sort of mainstream press coverage. Charlie's a comedy writer, and he writes in the Guardian every time. And he, it looks like, has found their venue this year. It's going to be the second weekend in June in, would you believe, Watford, Hertfordshire. Actually, very close, funnily enough, to Waddesdon, which is the Rothschilds' big country pad. Yeah, just down the road. So very convenient for them to nip into this Bilderberg meeting. Kissinger will be there.
Right.
Is this the guy who... How many coups did he organise in the 1970s?
Why is he still involved, though?
Is he still out of jail?
Yeah, well,
what, you know,
God, he must be like 90 now.
I don't know. He can't go to France. There are about four or five countries he can't go to. Italy is another one, because he'll be arrested if he goes. Oh, but we'll give him a red carpet treatment here in Britain. Even though he organised the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, the coup in Indonesia, the coup in Chile. I mean, you know, where you could just go on and on and on with him.
Cool. Well, I'm going to play another tune. You we were talking about the Bullingdon Club. This is The Jam.
Down my shirt. We won a match for the long time wait. That's something.
Jam, the Eton Rifles. So I'm with Tony Gosling, who normally presents a show on, is it Friday Drive Time?
The politics show.
The politics show, Friday Drive Time. And obviously, we have to be strictly impartial, or you have to be normally. So it's a good opportunity for him to have a rant and be as partial as he likes on my show.
Yeah, you've just had a go at the Lib Dems. You've had a go at the...
It's my show, I'm the presenter, right? Sorry. Okay, yeah. Right. So
I know my place.
Yeah, you know your place. So I've been looking at the polls, and the Tories recently achieved their lowest poll rating for some time. They're down to 28% in some of the polls. And interesting, what's really interesting, because of the first past the post system, normally it benefits the Tories. But once the Tories get below 30% in the votes, they actually get less than their fair share of seats. Whereas when they get more than 30%, they get more than their fair share. So the Tories could be harmed really badly at the next election.
No. What they're doing is they're having a boundary commission changes. So they're changing the boundaries.
Well, no, the Lib Dems have blocked it, haven't they? Anyway, you know this old 600 seat thing they wanted to... you know that's not going to happen.
Right, yes, that's right, yeah.
But anyway, whichever way you look at it, it's looking increasingly likely that Labour are going to romp home at the general election next time. So what do you make of Labour?
Labour, well... I mean, what they do is they seem to go for the middle ground, don't they? They do the focus group politics, which, you know, actually I find rather dull, because isn't it Kettering or something? I think Kettering is supposed to be the place where all the swing voters are. Yeah. If you find out what people in Kettering want, then you have... then you'll get all the sort of swing voters in the middle ground, and that apparently is the most important votes to get.
Okay.
But the thing is, there's nothing really very inspiring about Ed Miliband. You know, he doesn't really seem to have a great vision. It all seems to be based on what the existing coalition are up to. There isn't anything sort of really exciting new that he's planning, and I think there's just a complete lack of vision.
Like
the old Labour governments, you know, things like the Open University was brought in, completely new, completely different, which is egalitarian, open to everybody. But what are they doing? They're also saying that they should that they think that people who haven't paid enough national insurance contributions or, you know, tax. No, actually, they didn't say national insurance contributions. They said tax. This is the weekend before last. If you haven't paid enough tax, then you shouldn't be entitled to benefits. Well, what the hell's that all about?
Yeah.
You know, what about people who, you know, people who aren't able to work, for example?
Yeah.
And also, you know, how the hell are you supposed to get one of these 6.5 million, you know, jobs that don't exist?
Yeah.
There's a sort of schizophrenia about the Labour, that they seem to think that the jobs are there.
I must pick you up on misusing the word schizophrenia. It's you shouldn't use it to mean...
It means split personality, right?
Yeah.
That they think somebody's, you know, that there's two kind of things going on at the same time, that there's a complete disconnect with the real world.
Yeah.
That, oh yes, everyone can have a job. Well, they can't, because the jobs ain't out there.
I mean, this is one thing that it seems that the current government have largely got away with, which is to ignore the shortage of jobs and constantly give this sort of picture of, if only these people got off their arses and got out to work, then, you know, you wouldn't have to pay their benefits.
Think about those industries.
The fact that there aren't enough jobs to
go
around.
The industries that the jobs used to be in. I mean, you know, we can go through a few. The buses, you think there used to be two people employed in every bus. Also, the buses used to be properly maintained. There were jobs employing people to maintain buses, so the bus doesn't break down halfway through the journey and they have to bring out a tow truck or whatever it is, you know,
nowadays. This whole thing about conductors
on buses. Privatisation has meant a loss of millions and millions of jobs.
Yeah, but you could look at that in terms of efficiency and reducing costs. So clearly your buses are now cheaper to run.
Money for the shareholders.
Well, or cheaper fares. You know, if you believe in competition, then clearly a bus operator that can run his buses cheaper and offer you a lower fare.
It's a no-brainer, right? If you've got fat cat bosses and shareholders taking profits out of an industry, then it's going to cost more, not less.
Yeah, I see that. But nonetheless, reducing costs can be reflected in lower costs to the user.
Every single industry in this country, it seems to me, is getting rid of people. It's trying to employ as few people as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a large part of this, I suppose, is to do with the fact that rents are so high. I mean, you know, there is no free market in rent. You know, it's just, you go out there and look at those empty offices, for example.
Yeah.
Are you going to, if you want to rent somewhere, you would think that if there was a free market in it, that the people who owned those office buildings would be dropping the rent to fill the places up, but they don't.
Well, maybe they do, and there
just
aren't
a free market.
No, but maybe they do, and there just isn't enough business to fill them. You know what I mean? Maybe there's a glut of office space.
Maybe they get tax breaks even when the place is empty. You know,
right.
A lot of people buy buildings, big buildings nowadays. And this includes, private houses as an investment. You know, think of the second homes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people are worried about putting their money into the stock exchange, other sorts of investments. Oh, bricks and mortar. Let's buy some bricks and mortar. And this is why there is no real market in rent. And when was the last time your landlord said to you, oh, we're dropping the rent?
Well... it never happened, although I do pay. I am in the fortunate position to have a very low rent, but no, it's never happened.
How did you manage that then?
Because I know the landlord is.
Okay, well, I mean, that's all right. That's great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, for many people out there, they're never going to see their rents. Everything is just going up. The bills, yeah. Utilities are going up. Life is just becoming harder and harder and harder. And a large part of the reason for that is because the government has lost control of most of the country. All of the networks that we used to have, I was talking about buses, we're talking about, you know, our ports. Shipbuilding was privatised in 1983. British Leyland, the car manufacturer, was privatised in 1984. BT was privatised in 1984 too. The British Airports Authority were privatised in 1986. Now, these things used to be run as a public service, right? Which meant that the service came first, right? You had to have a look at what is needed to be done. You employ the people to do it, and then you start looking at the books to say, right, how much are we going to have to charge for this? It's all planned. Nowadays, we've just got shareholders wanting more and more dividends every year, and so what you do is you sack people. You're trying to make more and more money. You're basically spending less and taking more from people all the time. Aren't you?
Well, yes and no. Actually, no. I better challenge you on that. Come on, British Leyland in the 70s. I mean, you know, the nowadays we're producing more cars of much, much better quality than in the 70s, aren't we? You can't really say that that's not a success story.
Well. I think, yes, I mean, yes, you're probably right on British Leyland, because it was kind of running downhill, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The only trouble was that, you know, there was a whole sort of macroeconomic problem as well going on. The government didn't have enough money to invest in these. I mean, Kevin Livingstone again made this point that the investment back in the 70s was much greater than in the 80s, and it's one of the reasons that they had to privatise many of these things, is because there was no investment. It's almost like, say you're running a railway and you're not actually replacing your rails, you're not replacing anything, you're just running it into the ground. Slowly, that was what was happening through the 80s, because all these nationalised industries were not, and there was no investment. I mean, you know, basically because there'd been tax breaks for the rich. That's what had happened at the beginning of the 80s. That's what Thatcher brought in. You got tax breaks for the rich, and that tax that was being taken from the rich was doing this, you know, helping to pay for the entire infrastructure of the country. Margaret Thatcher took that away, and so all these industries started running down, yeah, including the railways, which were privatised after her era.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't the investment in them, and, you know, and that was, I suppose, the long-term fact is that all this stuff that we used to own, and we're talking hundreds of billions of pounds worth of infrastructure, was sold off.
Yeah.
That used to be ours, and it was the family silver, and it was sold off. And so it ultimately, you know, it was a kind of robbery, really.
Yeah. Okay, another tune. This is Stevie Wonder. This is Heaven Help Us All.
The child who never had a home. Heaven help the girl who walks the streets alone. Heaven help the roses if the bombs begin to fall. Heaven help us all. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl. Heaven help us all.
from the mighty, and the mighty from the small.
Heaven help us all, that's Stevie Wonder. So I just want to go back to the opinion polls, actually, because we're seeing the rise of UKIP. And UKIP are sort of polling sometimes as much as 15%, and they seem to be on a par with the Lib Dems. Now, whether that will translate into seats at the next election, who knows? But it's often been suggested that it's splitting the Tory vote.
Well, it's a bit like respect with the Labour, isn't it? And the Greens, actually probably more like the Greens. The left split a long time ago, I suppose, after under the Kinnock years.
Well, I could go even further, because you know, if you regard, and obviously it's, you can joke about this, but to some extent the Lib Dems have always been a little bit left leaning, and so the anti-Tory vote has always been split between the Lib Dems and Labour, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering whether firstly whether it will translate into any electoral success, and whether either, well, both Nigel Farage and David Cameron will swallow their pride and do some sort of pact.
Well, they might possibly. That's definitely a possibility. But one thing's for sure, we've got this little sort of caucus of UKIP growing in Bristol, down in Bradley Stoke.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's largely to do with Jack Lopresti, the Conservative MP, down there, attitude to Filton Airport. And there's a lot of people very disillusioned with Jack. And
in what sense? What's he done or
well,
not done?
Well, I mean, he's been supportive of the sell-off of...
Okay. Right.
You know, I mean, you know, this all does tie back in a weird way to Thatcher, because it was her that privatised British Aerospace. That used to be public property, public land. It's then privatised. And the idea that, you know, you can have a major, you know, Rolls-Royce, Airbus, GKN, and all the other, in fact, British Aerospace themselves have got offices down at Filton.
Right.
That you can have this aerospace industry with no runway.
Yeah.
You know, is just a bit of a no-brainer again, isn't it? I mean, yeah, so a lot of the, and there's also, I mean, there are other aspects to this, largely to do with how it is going to affect the quality of life for people in Bradley Stoke to have tens of thousands of houses built on the old Filton Airfield site.
Yeah.
Of course, there just isn't the infrastructure that can be able to cope with it.
Yeah.
I mean, that road is already incredibly busy.
It is. The exception, of course, is the railway, where there's scope to open this thing called the Henbury Loop, which goes past Filton Airfield, which would allow better public transport for any new homes there.
Yes. Well, they could probably, yes, they could come into Templemeads, maybe.
Yeah.
But you know, ultimately, there doesn't seem to be any real thought about the planning for this. And this is one of the reasons why many of the Conservative councillors in Bradley Stoke have gone over to UKIP. Really, it was almost a sort of domino effect. One or two did, and another one, and one of the women has now gone over. I think it was one of the people who was a former mayor of Bradley Stoke. Anyway, I can't remember all the details, but certainly there's quite a strong UKIP caucus around that area. People really who are disillusioned,
yeah,
with this, you know, the approach of Jack Lopresti, particularly our Freemason MP.
Right, okay.
Who's, you know, probably one of the only ones who's confessed to being a Freemason, but he is a Freemason. And, of course, that doesn't inspire confidence in people when you have somebody who's, you know, sworn oaths of allegiance to their own little club, where, you know, one always is going to ask, where do your loyalties lie? And these are blood-curdling oaths they swear.
Right.
You know, it's not just a little, you know, I swear to uphold the rules of the golf club. No.
Yeah.
It's actually quite, you know, nasty. If people want to look into it, you can find out online some of the gory details of what you swear to when you join the Freemasons. But, you know, there's obviously going to be divided loyalties for someone that's making promises like that to their mates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And at the other end of the spectrum, then, there is the Greens.
Well, they're doing quite well, aren't they?
Well, are they? I mean, they're still sort of scraping 1 or 2% in the polls.
Every election or every couple of elections, they seem to get another councillor in the city.
Right.
We've also now got Gus Hoyt, who's the Ashley councillor, on the cabinet with the mayor of Bristol. A lot of people are saying, well, this is actually selling out, you know, that what you're doing is you just want to be in the club with the big boys, and actually now you're part of the problem of all the cuts that are going on across the city, you know, the millions of pounds worth of cuts. So, you know, well, it'll be interesting to see in a few few weeks' time in the local elections here how this pans out, whether this works, whether this works for the Greens. It's a bit of a risky policy. I mean, I would say, you know, to actually be involved in signing off these cuts, you know, is not necessarily going to endear you to the voters.
It is analogous to the Lib Dems going into coalition with the Tories, really, isn't it? In you know, like
It certainly is. One thing I will point out, though, is that we've got a rather dodgy situation going on with Mayor Ferguson, where he's employed, not employed, he's not paying, it's an unpaid advisor, this guy from KPMG, Matt Payne, is one of his unpaid advisors, and there really have, I mean, there are serious questions about KPMG. We had a story in the press last week about KPMG signing off all the accounts for the big banks in the run-up to 2008. I mean, missing tens of billions of pounds on their books, saying, well, we thought that was all okay, and we've signed off the accounts and everything, but actually, the accounts were rubbish. It was, may as well be loo paper, you know, you could burn them. They were worth nothing. This audit was worth nothing that KPMG had done. So is it a good idea to have Matt Payne from KPMG up at the council house, sorry, what's it called now, City Hall, you know, going through all our taxpayers' money and saying, well, I think money should go here and we should be spending on this and this and this. Doesn't seem right to me. And you know, it may be that Matt thinks about, you know, whether he's the right person for that, or maybe George thinks about whether he's the right person to be in there, while also KPMG are under investigation by the Competition Commission for price fixing with all the other big four auditing firms. There's an investigation into them now for fraud.
Cool. Okay, I'm going to play another tune. I'm with Tony Gosling. We need to cover the official Monster Raving Loony Party, don't we, in the interest of balance?
Of course, for which I believe you're standing.
Yes, I am, yes, following your footsteps. I should start the official... I have thought, actually, just for a laugh, you know, to stand as Steve Satan. I did talk with the idea for the mayor thing, you know, and the official party.
Have you seen this thing called the birthday party?
Yeah, I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe, I think, you'd fit in with that, because they're sort of rather silly, but in a way, they're saying, well, look, you know, you could drag a tramp off the street, and they do better than many of these politicians.
And
I could see you sort of going along with that line. Not to say you are a tramp on the street.
No, thanks. Yeah, but I might end up coming up with some sensible comments there, which would obviously spoil
no,
it.
No, come on. I doubt it. just to let listeners know, this timeline I've done, the Thatcher timeline from 1970 when she entered the cabinet, and all these privatisations. I mean, we forget, don't we? British Steel, 1988, British Aerospace.
Well, it's not just the biggies, though, isn't it? It's the little ones like Amersham International. And
were they?
Well, that was the first ever privatisation.
It was a test, was it?
Yeah, it was like a test, yeah, a very small nationalised firm. And I can't remember what they did. I'll look it up, maybe, on the internet.
Water boards, British Airports Authority, of course, BP.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, do you remember that? You know, that massive petroleum industry that controls the world? Well, we used to own it.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't know more. So all that is available on my Friday page, which is on the BCFM's website. The easiest way to go there is straight to that page, is thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk. It gives you the list of all of the different privatisations. And I guess... the reason I'm a bone picking with you now, because I still really think that it was monetary union. Margaret Thatcher said, "I refuse to hand over this sovereign nation to 13 unelected bankers."
Yeah.
And within 2 weeks, she was out. Poll tax had happened. The poll tax riots were eight months before.
Yeah, yeah, but that's the whole point. That's the sort of
already decided that it wasn't going to work.
No, but that was the sort of fate. I don't know. I mean, the debate will race forever. But the poll tax, that was the sort of fatal wounding of the government, the fatal loss of credibility, and from there on, people thought, right, okay, we've got to get rid of Thatcher, because you know she's a lame duck. She's a liability at that point.
Well, maybe.
Maybe what you're talking about was the straw that broke the camel's back.
I think the poll tax was the cover. That actually the monetary union was really what it was all about.
Yeah, well. We'll let that one rest. We can rave and rave and rave about that forever. Look it up on the internet.
Anyway, thanks for letting me have my...
You're both welcome.
Venting my spleen.
Vent away. You're on your own show then. He's on Friday.
That's it, 5 till 7. We've got another politician this week. Can't remember who. I think we've got Conservative from the City Council on from 5 till 6. And then our investigative reports, as usual, from 6 till 7 on Friday. Last week we did a whole thing about this film the BBC have made.
Yeah.
But they won't show. The BBC half paid for it with The Guardian. It's a film about this guy James Steele, who's been organising death squads and torture chambers in Iraq, and is still out in Iraq doing his dirty work. And the BBC won't show it. But even though our licence fee payers' money has been spent on making the film, they're not going to show it on the telly. This is what happens when you put the BBC in charge of Chris Patten, a former Tory cabinet minister, who, by the way, went into a nice safe seat in Bath, didn't he? Do you remember that?
Yeah, and lost.
And then he lost. People of Bath kicked him out. So he's a completely failed politician, now running Tory, running the BBC. And I think, you know, something needs to happen there. But I don't think necessarily Mr Cameron is going to be the one to change
it. No, it's not, is he? Okay, this is Muse. This is Feeling Good. Tone, thanks for coming in.
Birds flying high.